Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Eternal Optimist Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Drinkon, and today we have on the show Mr. Gray McKenzie. And Gray comes recommended to us today by my good friend Hector Santiesteban, who is my podcast producer, who has the Modern Masculinity Podcast, who's a Front Row dad, and also a former Cutco glory. So shout out to Hector for making this recommendation. Let's welcome Mr. Gray McKenzie. Gray, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, man. I'm excited to be here and chat with you.
Yeah, super excited to be here. We were chatting a little bit beforehand, and team out there, dear listener, I believe you're going to find Gray is an eternal optimist. Just the way that he's responding to challenges out there in his world, it's pretty inspirational. So I think we're going to find some good stuff today, but I'll let you be the judge of that, dear listener. So Gray, let's kick things off with a little bit of context. If you had to give us just three bullet points, three things about you that could give us just a little bit of context as to who's speaking right now, what are just three things set the tone for us about who Gray McKenzie is?
Yeah. Maybe we'll start with philosophy. Like, first, I think relationships matter most. So I have shifted our life around a lot to prioritize relationships from business to what we do personally. Second one would be just professionally. I run a training and consulting firm called Zen Pilot. We help agencies and professional services businesses streamline their operations on top of a project management platform called ClickUp. And then personally, I'm a husband. I've got 4 awesome little kiddos, and we are doing everything we can to try and raise them well and teach them the reasons for eternal optimism.
Holy cannoli. Okay. Well, all I heard was 4 kids. So I know that you were like super busy and going like 100 miles an hour under the water right now, but you come off super cool. So this is great. And team, if you were to zoom in and check us out on YouTube right now, Gray has the most amazing beard, and it doesn't have any gray in it, but he has the most amazing beard. So you guys all know my fascination with facial hair since I don't grow any. But Gray, start us off on the track. I'd like to ask you to go back in time, and it can be an hour ago, or it can go all the way back to birth. Just take us back in the time machine to somewhere that you had something really challenging show up in your life. And if you could start at a really challenging intersection and tell us a story, we'd love to start there.
Yeah. I'll get the overwhelming theme, but the story is taking baseball really seriously as a sport growing up and the source of a lot of my identity. And then for a variety of reasons, not being able to play baseball at the next level beyond high school was a huge, like, that was a big blow to my identity at probably 18 years old, trying to figure out next steps.
When did you realize that you were not going to be playing baseball, or when did you realize and accept that you were not going to be playing baseball at the next level out of high school?
Yeah. So probably like senior year of high school, and the struggle between what I wanted to pursue professionally, like next step, and what I wanted to do, was there was already tension around like, hey, where do I wind up going to school and whatever else? And then dealing with shoulder injuries throughout senior year was like, hey, what does this mean like at the next step for me? And am I willing to wait longer to go through whatever the process is to try to pursue baseball or to move on to something else? And that was coinciding with a lot of stuff, just kind of realizations and challenges personally around who I was and so much of my identity being tied up in performance. That was the start, or the first time maybe that I'd struggled with the tie so strongly between identity and performance. And that's been a lifelong challenge.
Yes. I'm going to go down a tangent for a second, share my similar story around this, because I really deeply resonate with you on the identity portion of, you know, being someone who played ball. For me, it was golf. Played high school golf, very high level, and went to the state championships, recruited for golf scholarships in college. And then I finally went to college, not on a golf scholarship, but I went on an academic scholarship. And when I went to golf tryouts for the team, like 25 people showed up. They're going to take like 10 people-ish, 10 or 10 or 11 people. And they had 7 players on scholarship. So here I am. I'm going to walk on the team. And I kind of liken it to that movie, Son of a Woman, with Al Pacino and Chris O'Donnell, maybe. He was the poor kid going to that really rich school on scholarship. And I felt like that when I went to this nice college called Wofford down in South Carolina. So I go to school, and there's a gap of 3 weeks between the day I arrive at college and then when tryouts start. In those 3 weeks, if I'm at home back with my parents, I get to play off their membership at the course, and I get to practice. I worked at the golf course, so I get to play for free anyways. But I get to college, and for 3 weeks, I mean, we're there on an academic scholarship. I don't have any money. I don't have the ability to go and actually practice. At least I didn't think I did at the time. And when tryouts come, I'm a little bit rusty. So I ended up finishing in 10th place in the tryout. And they're going to take, I think, 11 players. And they cut me. And I tell you what, Gray, that moment that I got cut from the golf team my freshman year of college was like the biggest blow of my life to date. I remember putting a towel over my head and walking back to my car crying. I'm 18. I don't know how to express emotion at this point. And I've been taught at this point, at least, that you don't cry. If you're a man, you don't cry. You keep it inside and you don't share that with others. Is that something for you? I have a different thought on that now. But at the time, I didn't want to show that emotion. So I felt ashamed, embarrassed. I just felt all kinds of ways about that. So that was my instant that I realized I'm not going to play on the golf team at this moment. So I wonder if you had like a cathartic moment where your emotion overcame you or where you felt something like that when you were in high school going through injuries and realizing it.
Yeah, kind of an array of moments similar to that initial frustration with injury and then how that impacts performance was probably the starting point. I think ultimately probably the hardest moment was saying no to deciding for sure, hey, I'm going to go to a different school and I'm going to study business instead of like, hey, I'm not going to wind up playing here right now. So I'm going to wind up going to a different school and study business and pursue something else. It was like a weirdly somewhat emotional moment for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, take us back to that moment, just when the moment the decision was made, when you decided, you know what, I'm going to this school. What was going on in your mind, if you can recount?
Yeah. I mean, just a lot of sadness. Like it was, I experienced grief at losing family members or in other ways. And similar to you, like there's not a lot of, for a lot of us probably who grew up same time frame and for a lot of years and decades and centuries before, there's not a lot of education around how to deal with emotion. And what's the idea of grieving your own loss in a way where everything's still fine? You're just missing out on this one. Yeah. Like we have this weird obsession with sports in American culture, probably in a lot of cultures. And so, hey, guess what? You don't get to do something at the level that you want to do something. Like, not that on the surface level, it's certainly a first world problem, but there still is loss and there still is grief there. So a lot of sadness and disappointment, frustration. And then I think all of the stages of grief kind of play into it. Like at first, denial. And then so the moments that I remember most were kind of the acceptance moments of, no, this is really happening. I think that's why that one sticks out to me. Hey, I am making a decision to do something separate here and to go, like me signing to go to Grove City, where I ultimately went for business, is a move away from accepting, hey, I'm not ready to play baseball at the next level right now. A lot of different emotions, but a lot of sadness in that moment at the time.
Key word there, at some point you accepted it. And for me, at least, that's when I accepted that this is the result that happened, then I could move on to the next strategy, the next thing. And coincidentally, in that college golf thing, what happened for me, I accepted that I got cut from the team. I then quickly moved to a place of, you know, how can I keep my golf game there? How can I accept this isn't it for me? I'm not done. I'm done for this moment. But how do I continue to move forward? So I ended up going to the coach of the women's golf team and ended up becoming the manager of the women's golf team in college. So I got to go out there and still play golf every day and keep my game sharp. And then I made the team. I was on the team for the next 2 years at Wofford. But I was able to accept that this decision was made and not play victim and not be blaming someone else. I just had to learn to own it myself. And that was really hard. It was really hard for me to do that. But I want to say, on a deeper issue that you had shared, you spoke some real good wisdom, is that you acknowledge that, yes, this is probably a first world problem. Like it's not the biggest thing in the whole universe. And at the same time, it is big to me and it's okay to be sad about it. You know, so it's okay that it's not the biggest thing and it can be saddening for me. It's okay to have both those things present. And how do we deal with it and work through it? And maybe there wasn't a manual or a way that was commonly known a couple decades back on how to do that. But you've done it. And I've done it. And for our listeners out there, it is possible to do that. It is possible to not get what you want and be sad about it and accept it and find a way to move on, overcome, adapt, whatever it is. But Gray has done that. I'm curious, is this resilience, acceptance, this way that you were able to move on, where else has this skill or this awareness shown up in your life since then?
Yeah, I think all of life is like this series of obstacles that we overcome. And at least in the first stage, kind of from adolescence through, I think for probably for many people, like through mid 30s, some people maybe early 30s, some people maybe 40s, we're on this hunt, like we're pursuing stuff. We're pursuing excellence in whatever our field is, you know, athletics or whatever. And then that shifts into career-wise, it's like the big thing is get a job, and then it's get another job, and then it's find the woman or find your partner, and then it's, you know, buy a house. And there's like this series that of obstacles that our culture has laid out that we're trying to pursue and create achievement in. In each of those things, or in many of those areas, like there will be obstacles. You know, there's the breakup, or the you got let go from a job, or you didn't earn as much money as you're hoping to, so you couldn't buy the house that you wanted, or whatever else that is. And at some point, I think we shift from that mode. I think this is why the midlife crisis term pops up a lot. It's like, hey, I've checked all those boxes that I could imagine 20 years ago. To some degree, there's always new boxes, but there's enough of a pattern here that this isn't making me happy. We talk more about that at some point. But I think the other ways that that showed up for me, or that pattern of moving past it, is continuing to overcome the same challenge, which is my identity was so invested in my performance on a baseball diamond early on, that then having that taken away was a huge blow to my identity. And then same thing happened, you know, business-wise, like our first agency that we built, and then a software business that we built. Identity so lumped into what we're building very early on that a shift in direction or hardship in business, like it was just the emotional roller coaster, the ups and downs of if you tracked business performance. And then my emotional state for the first probably 2 or 3 years of entrepreneurship, like very, very closely tied together.
Yeah. Well, is that because you were forming a new identity as an entrepreneur, and when you were succeeding, you were on high, and when you were challenged, you were really low? Was it tied up in the results? I think that's what you're saying. Just want to make sure. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Okay. So at what point in your entrepreneurial journey, if you've gotten there, or if this even connects with you, at what point are you able to be identity neutral or identity value centric, or move to an identity that doesn't quite have as much power over you all the time?
Yeah. Well, I will let you know when I get there.
Yeah.
It's much different today than it was in the past. So I don't think it's like, hey, your identity is either fully tied to performance or not at all. So a huge part for me of this journey has been my faith journey as well. Becoming a Christian, learning that, hey, my identity is no longer tied up in how I perform in a specific arena or area. And although I know that to be true, there's still the day-to-day challenge of like living with that freedom. And that was a huge, so I wound up not playing baseball. That kind of sadness, anger, and grief originally turned into the opportunity to play lacrosse in college, which was a tremendous relationship building avenue for me. My best friend came from the lacrosse team. We'd started and ran 3 different businesses together. And so there's a lot of blessings in that. But there's this huge moment of freedom that happened between my sophomore and junior year, where I was a third string midfielder my sophomore year in college. Grew a lot spiritually in the summer that I was away, and felt a huge sense of freedom, like a big weight lifted off my shoulders coming back in the fall. Of like, hey, who cares? Like, I'm just going to go out here and have fun and do my best, and whatever happens, happens. I put a lot less pressure on myself and had a lot less weight that I felt like I was carrying. I remember that fall ball, the field just opened up and was seeing cuts that I didn't see before, seeing things that I hadn't seen before. So that was my first real strong affiliation and experience of the freedom of my identity not being tied to my performance actually has the positive effect of often improving our performance.
What role did your faith play in being able to let go of identity being tied to results? So you mentioned that becoming a Christian in your faith journey has helped you on the journey. So how exactly did that cut off some of that pressure of being tied to results and identity?
Right. Basically just taking the gospel to heart of the person whose opinion, the only person whose opinion matters of me is God's opinion. And when God looks at me, it's not, here's all the things that you've done wrong today, and here's the few things that you've done right today, and there's this thing. But God is looking at the work of Jesus, the perfect work of Jesus, who died and took my sin for me. And so I've got ultimate freedom. Like when God looks at me today, he sees the righteousness of Jesus that's been imputed to me. And that created this like big sense of freedom then of all the pressure of pleasing other people started to fade away. It's certainly not gone. I still have people pleasing tendencies for sure, but But that has diminished greatly compared to if you were talking to 17 or 18 year old Gray. Totally different reaction to disappointing Matt versus today.
Well, what would it be like today? Like if I'm a client of yours and you have this feeling that you're disappointing me, like what's different now than years ago?
Yeah. So I think the fact that I'm disappointing someone bothers me much less. The okay. process still bothers me. So there's still this drive and this call to be excellent that I think is on all of us. So if the process of what we're doing as a company, the process that I've designed or the work that I've done, if I've dropped the balls, that is disappointing and that's frustrating. And I would still feel pressure and I still would want to do everything I can to rectify that, to be excellent in everything that we're doing. But the fact that someone else is bothered by it, the perception of someone else, that's the main thing that would bother or drive me. It's the, hey, did we fail in the process here or did we not?
Good. Good. Well, thank you for walking down that little path with us there. Certainly appreciate the thought of how an identity can be all consuming and be like really high, really low, and through to your maturity, due to your faith. This has been something where your lens is totally shifted on it. I think part of that is if you're open to, well, faith is a huge part for me too. If you're open to faith, if you're open to the idea of this experience is here to teach me something, what is it that I can learn from this?
Yep.
Then we can turn the tables on the stuff that holds us back now.
Right.
I would ask you, where's a time in your life that you've had a real hard challenge that you viewed it as, this is a great teacher for me? And it could be this or anything else, but what's another example? I'll ask you for a different example of something that's been a really hard challenge for you that you've been able to reframe it as, I can learn from this. This is actually could be good.
Right. The first one that pops to mind is a business experience. So my business partner, Andrew, and I, our second company was a software company. It was a project management software startup specifically for agencies, grew to a little over 500 customers, and it bootstrapped it. And we really struggled with churn. At the time, we were coming from running an agency as our first business. So we were in the services business. Software seemed way cooler. I think it is still cooler. And so there was a lot of identity in being a SaaS founder that was super appealing to us and something that we really wanted. So we were doing the thing, but we were struggling to get churn consistently below 5% monthly. And we were at a point where it was like, hey, either we need to go raise money and go harder on this, or if we're going to keep bootstrapping, like we need to shift something. And so we wound up doing consulting services on top of the software to try to help people be more successful. All of our best customers were the ones who had the consulting help. And so it was like, hey, the market's telling us we're better as consultants at this stage of life, at least. And are we willing to accept that and go that route? Or are we going to dig our heels in and be SaaS founders? Because that's where a lot of our identity is being tempted to be. And so anyways, wound up going through probably the lowest 9 months of our entrepreneurial journey together and ultimately shifted the business, which has created the freedom to accept like what are our gifts, and consulting and training. We're much better teachers than we are software leaders right now at this stage of life. That has opened the doors to a much more both successful in terms of like financial performance and growth of Zenpilot, what we do today, but more importantly or equally importantly or whatever importance level you ascribe to this. But I think this is the virtuous flywheel that drives everything is our clients are much more successful as a result of being able to take the leap and let go of that part of the identity and be a, what I think most people in the professional ecosystem think is more of a boring business than a software business.
Yes.
But it's been one of the best things in retrospect.
What I love about your answer is that you started with, we let the market teach us and guide us, rather than staying put in our foxhole of it has to be this way because as SaaS founders, that's the way it's got to be. And you were open to where the profitable was. You were open to where the serving the customers was, where their feedback was. And I just so respect that about you, that you can let the odometer or navigator be the success or the feedback from your clients. So I certainly appreciate that. What I'm taking from that is you have a level of curiosity or practicality about you to listen. So it kind of says you're a good listener too.
Yeah, I think all those skills are not, I don't know if they come naturally. Like that's all a work in progress. And you're talking to me, that was end of 2016 into 2017. So you're hearing this 7 years later and not seeing the 9 months of like, no, we really want to do this. Let's try to figure it out. So it's certainly been a process, but you're absolutely right. Like we would not, without ultimately getting to the point of being willing to let it go, that would not have given us the freedom to move into this next and more successful stage of entrepreneurism.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to go into that with you. I want to hear a little bit about Zen Pilot, the way that you run it now. Did the name and brand start 7 or 8 years ago? You started at the origin. Okay. So tell me, who do you serve now? What do you guys do now?
Yeah. We help primarily marketing agencies and professional services teams, some in-house marketing teams as well, but streamline their operations on top of ClickUp. And really the three main areas when we talk about like streamlined operations, the three main things that we're focused on, or the three pillars, are the tools that they're using. So ClickUp's are always a piece of that in our current client engagements, the processes that their team runs on, and the habits that their team employs to make sure everyone's rowing in the same direction and being as productive as possible.
Excellent. So the ideal target market for you would be a marketing agency of some kind to be able to help them to be really focused on the tools they're using, the process they follow, and then the habits of their people.
That's right.
Okay. So if I'm a marketing agency and I'm curious about what you're talking about, I can see because I'm in the marketing world. So what might the first conversation sound like or feel like or first engagement look like?
We hear so many different pain points. Hey, I don't have visibility into my team's capacity. I don't know what we can say yes to and what we can't say yes to, or I can't see how this team's performing, or I can't see when we do this service line versus that service line, what's profitable and what's not profitable. Or we'll hear from individual contributors, you know, like, I don't know what's on my plate today. Like, my workload shifts by the Slack message that I get. I get a new message, then I've got a different thing to jump to. And just a lot of like chaos is what it all ultimately boils down to. And so what people are seeking is clarity. And so that's where a first conversation with us almost always winds up is, and it's probably 50-50 in our sales process. Folks who come to us and say, I'm running an agency, I don't know how to scale this and scale the client services side of this business. And so I need to build the infrastructures. This is not all reliant on me. And they're not concerned at all about a tool. And then the flip side, I've mentioned ClickUp a couple of times. The other half, or 50%, are the folks who are saying, hey, we're looking at using ClickUp, or we bought into ClickUp. We thought that this would solve the problem. And so we want help. We want consulting around solving this. And when you dig into both of those, they both ultimately boil down to, hey, we don't have visibility and we don't have clarity that everybody needs.
Good. Hey, I'm going to throw a quick curveball at you because you said something a few minutes ago that really struck me. You played lacrosse at a high level in college, and I'm curious, baseball players versus lacrosse players, who's tougher?
In different ways, lacrosse players are tougher.
Why do you say that?
Well, I guess this depends. So physically, lacrosse players are tougher. Mentally, you have to be tougher to be a baseball player.
Yeah.
So that's my strange
answer. A little bit of honor to both of them there. Nice. How about basketball players? Any feedback on them?
Basketball players, I think they're some of the best athletes are basketball players. I wish that I could be an excellent basketball player, but I'm just a pick a pooper. And I don't know, from a toughness perspective, I'd put them more in the lacrosse end of the spectrum. There's certainly a lot of dumb baseball players too, but to be successful, there's a level of mental toughness that the best baseball players have that is not always shared in other sports, even though I think in most sports you do need mental toughness, but that's my biased assessment at least.
Huh. Man, I was trying to catch you there.
Where do golfers fit in? Well, like the most mentally tough sport.
Look at the golfers of the 80s versus the golfers of now. Anybody could do it back then. And now you look at the people who are just pumping out on tour. They all have trainers. They all have diet regimens. They all do stretching and all kinds of physical exercises after they're done with every round. I mean, it is far more of a business now than just pure talent that it used to be back in the day. But the difference now is I say that these golfers are so fine-tuned on their regimen and their routine. I don't see many that have the type of routine that the top professional golfers in the world have. It's just airtight. It's the same. So I'm very curious to see, because we're recording right now on Friday, the 17th of May, and there was a tragedy that happened this morning in Valhalla at the PGA Championship. There was a vendor that was killed by a shuttle bus. And then Scottie Scheffler, the world's number one player, got arrested and went to jail this morning. I'm really curious. I mean, first of all, my heart goes out to the vendor's family. And after that, I'm really curious to see how Scottie Scheffler, the top player of the world, is going to perform after a complete shock to his system and his routine. Plus, he had a baby like a week ago. So I'm really curious about the mental aspect of how he approaches today and the rest of this week.
Yeah.
Frankly, you know, just because that's top of mind right now this morning. But what makes the golfer like a high level ability to focus for me on a very elite level is that they just pay strict attention to the details of their routine. and I imagine this is probably similar in your business of the higher performing clients, the more regimented they are with the clarity of what they want, of how they're going to get there and who they need to be to get there. It's probably very similar to what you and I do. I mean, you do it with a specific niche and I, as a business coach, do it with my own niche. But right. I would say it's training them and helping them to do the same. I'm going to pause because you got me excited talking about golf and yeah, back to you.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely true. Yeah. I think a lot of the focus, like, it all comes down to just saying no. And it's probably the same thing in, you know, I just think of baseball. Like, a lot of it is saying no. I'm not going to think about last at bat, or I'm not going to think about even that last pitch. Like, I'm focused on what's coming next. So much of high performing teams is choosing to say no to what we're going to focus on, or what we're going to accept as inputs. Like, what will we tolerate to then give you the ability to actually be consistent and be disciplined in, yes, these are the measurables that matter, and we're going to consistently make sure that these are moving in the right direction. These are the priorities we're going to push forward.
I wonder, have you faced that in your business in the first 7-8 years with Zen Pilot? Have you faced it where you found yourself, you were focused on this, but then you look back like a day, a week, a month, a year later, and you're like, I'm down the rabbit hole. I'm doing all these other things away from the top priority. Have you battled that yet in your professional
career? Sure. Yeah. We run on EOS, the Entrepreneurial Operating System, and there are very mixed opinions on that. But I think EOS does do a good job of saying, here's what the scorecard is. Here's how we're going to look at data to run our business. Here's how frequently we're going to look at it. We're going to look at it as a leadership team or as an individual team on every single week. And then we're going to take a deeper dive into it every single quarter and get realigned. And you've got these rhythms of everyone's on the same page, singing in harmony on day one of the quarter. And then 90 days later, things are starting, you know, there's loose ends starting to come out. And so that rhythm has been really helpful for us in building a discipline that we did not have in the first couple of years of what we were doing with Zen Pilot.
Yeah. I'd love to segue into project management because, you know, that's a special skill that you possess. And I wonder how, if you could just start and riff for us for a few minutes here on, you know, project management and what it takes to be like an exceptional project manager and leader in that space. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I think the word that I said earlier, clarity. Clarity truly is kindness, and it is the thing that all great project managers are excellent at creating for everyone. So from a, you know, executive stakeholder perspective, they're excellent at saying, hey, here's what we agreed upon at a high level. Here are the milestones. Here's the measurables of our success. And you've got real time or, you know, consistent basis updates on what that looks like. There's easy visibility and clarity into that. And then on the other side, so you think about the like demand and supply and the project managers sitting in the middle, you've got the stakeholders saying, here's what we want, whether that's a client or that's an internal team. And then you've got that's the demand. And then you've got the supply side, which is, you know, what's your team and the resources you're able to marshal to execute that project. And so they're excellent then at each of the demand resources or fulfillment resources, able to give them clarity on, here's exactly what I need from you at a zoomed out level across the length of this project. Here's the high level of what I need you to do. And then at a very granular level, here's what I need you to get done today and move through the process. And the more repeatable those types of projects are, the more efficiency you're creating for yourself as a project manager. I can now have a project template for how this whole thing's going to play out. So when you've got more repeatable stuff, that's much easier to do and it will take less time from a project manager.
Yes.
And then the less repeatable things are, the more you're innovating each time,
yes,
then the less efficiency you're going to find, which is fine as well.
Yeah. Is your project management, I'll call it your dashboard or the metrics that you look at for you? You say you use the EOS system to keep the machine of the business going in a very organized, structured way. Do you use like a ClickUp dashboard or template to run your own practice?
Yeah.
Watching, yep. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
And it gives you crystal clear clarity on everything, every metric. What are the most important metrics to you in leading other marketing agencies?
Yep. So if we zoomed out to like a leadership level scorecard, yeah, we're looking at client health, we're looking at team utilization, what's the bandwidth to continue executing, and we're looking at referrals as one of our, so we've got two different ways that we're measuring health. One is referrals, how many people are actually telling other people, and then what is the actual client health scores, which we could dig into deeper if it's helpful.
But yeah, I'd love to dig deeper into that. I love going the rabbit hole on how you measure things since this is what you're best at. Love to hear what this looks like.
Cool. So, and then from just a couple other metrics, then we'll go to client health.
Okay.
So in terms of our delivery team and our overall team, we're looking at what's our overall capacity say, here's all the hours that we have, our target utilization. So what would that wind up looking like? And then we're looking at how much work is estimated out against our capacity. Of the total capacity that we have, how much is already pre-spoken for as we're looking forward? And then how much is remaining and available for us to fill? And then it's, hey, what do we do with the supply that we have here to best make that make sense? If we've got more time, that's going to get repurposed into internal R&D, or if there's client upsells or places to go above and beyond with clients, we'll go do that as well. And then obviously, if we're on the other end of the spectrum, then we're looking at, well, what do we need to change from a staffing perspective? Because we've got to bring on more help. And then on the client health side, we're looking at, so in any client reporting environment, there's four main areas that are, maybe these are, I don't know if these are quadrants, but four main categories that you'd report to a client on. The first one is, what did we do? The activity. Second one is, what were the results? So our performance. Third one is, what did we learn? And this is really the thinking part in the text of, hey, we tried this to accomplish this. The results were this. Therefore, we learned this. And the last part is, what are we doing as a result of that? So when we are looking at client health, we're looking at externally what they're saying through NPS, Net Promoter Score. If it's helpful to spend any time on that, we can...
For those who don't know what that is, give us a 30-second overview of Net Promoter Score, or minute overview.
Yeah, Net Promoter Score is just one. It's the most common metric that companies use, like Apple uses this, a ton of companies use, and it's that annoying question that you've probably gotten asked and closed out of 100 times, which is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you to refer this
product? That one, yes, yes.
The way you calculate that score is your 9s and 10s are promoters. Anything that's a 6 or below is called a detractor. And then your passives are 7s and 8s. So you take the percentage of, let's say we have 100 people respond, 90 of them, which would be, or 80 of them, which would be excellent, say, yeah, we're a 9 or a 10. We would definitely refer you.
Yeah.
We ignore the percentage of passives that we have. So let's say 10 give us a 7 or an 8, and then 10 give us a 6 or below. So those are our detractors. So 10% are detractors, 80% are promoters. And so our NPS score is 80 minus 10. So 70 is our NPS score.
What do you do with that now?
Yeah. So that's a kind of high level metric to be able to see. Like, I really care about that in an aggregate. What's the trend over time? If you're an excellent services-based business, you're in the 60s, probably the low 60s is like a very good services-based business. If you're a product business, it's generally lower than that. The more high touch, generally the higher NPS should be as well. So the more luxury you are, more expensive you are, generally higher NPS as well. But I care about how that trends over time. So if I'm working with an agency, or if this was us and we're sitting at 30, then hey, like, unlikely to go to 60 tomorrow, but let's see what the trend over time is. Can we bring that up? What do we need to change? You know, everything starts, the sales is the sample of what we ultimately get. So is it wrong expectations set in the sales process, or is it poor execution against those expectations?
Yes.
From a delivery side.
Yeah, I love nerding out down the rabbit hole with this one. What I preach is expectations on the front end, on how we're going to communicate, what you can expect from me, what should I expect from you, you know, how we're going to communicate in a crisis, or if something is expectations not met, how do you want me to communicate with you there? So I'm big on the expectation. And you said earlier that clarity is kindness. Couldn't agree more. Can you elaborate on that? Clarity is kindness, and how it relates to kind of where we're at right now.
Yeah, expectations. So 100%. I think there's this perception that we need to go above and beyond expectations in order to delight our clients or whoever we're.
That's the mantra that we're trained and taught growing up. That you got to far exceed expectations.
Yeah, it's not at all true. It's just, can you consistently meet expectations? And the consistent part is the huge part. Hey, Matt, I'm going to show up at 10:45 for this podcast. Then, like, I can't be showing up sometime. The worst thing would be if I showed up half the time at 10:30. To go above and beyond your expectations, and I'm all set and prepared. And then half the time I'm showing up at 11 o'clock. Those things don't even out. It'd be much better to just consistently show up. Hey, I'm here at 10:45 and I'm ready to go for the podcast. And that's what builds trust, is people knowing, hey, the expectations that I get may not always be what I want to hear, but they're always met. And so that creates trust in a relationship. And when people know that they can trust you, they'll rely on you and they'll be willing to spend more or work with you more closely, as long as there's actual movement towards the results that they want. There may be a natural end that happens when you do that, but there won't be the super frustrated customers when expectations are clearly aligned.
Absolutely. And I love the way that you're measuring the health of the client with the referrals one, net promoter score overall, but you talked about the actual measuring, what do we actually do? What results do we get? What do we learn from it? And what are we going to do as a result of the learnings? That's a four-step process. To any listener, go back and listen to that. Because when Gray talks about that, spot on, like that's 100% the way that we as people running businesses, as people serving others, I hesitate to say the word should, because that's a perfectionist word to me.
Right, right.
And that's the way it should be done, ladies and gentlemen. That is exactly the way it should be done. So anything you want to add on that?
I think from a client health perspective, we use two scores that we're balancing against each other. NPS from the client is one.
Yeah. Okay.
We have an internal health score that's assigned by the account manager, whoever's leading the account, typically on a weekly basis. They answer these four questions and then create a client health score for us on a scale of 1 to 5. And this is their perception of the account. There's some rules around it. And what we're looking for is any mismatch between an NPS score that a client gave us and then what our internal team's perception of the account was. But the four questions that we're asking that are open-ended questions are, and they try to be prompting questions. So the first one is, why would the client be unhappy with the progress we've made? And so it's not, is the client unhappy? Because you'll get a whole lot of no's, but why forces people to think to the next layer of like, oh, is there anything that would throw them off? Second one is, are you happy with the account? So the client might be totally happy. You might be disrespected in the relationship, or you might foresee things happening that will cause the client to be unhappy down the road, or it might just be taking up more of your time than you wish it did. Or, you know, there's a number of reasons that an internal person might be unhappy with the account that they're managing. That's the second question. Third question is, are there any changes in the strategy since the last update? So what's different? What has changed that maybe, you know, your head of that team or head of delivery needs to know about, or your project manager needs to know about? And then the last question is just the common, you know, is there anything you need help with on this account? And so those prompting questions are helpful then in getting the story. That combined with the client health score assigned internally and the NPS score from the client are kind of the three main pieces that then have to get coordinated together to say, hey, how healthy is this account actually? So that works well at scale.
Dude, I want to sit here and riff with you forever about project management and some of these questions and details, because I love them. I think you just gifted us an amazing question. For those of you out there listening, here's the place. If you're driving, then don't write it down when you're driving, obviously, but just check it out. Why would they be unhappy? What a great future thinking, planning question to really challenge where we are, because I think a lot of people may not even ask that. All right, so great question on the front end. Now, Gray, I'd love to go deeper, but let's start to move to wrap up with this.
Yeah.
There's a person out there who's part of a marketing agency or knows someone who runs a marketing agency, or there is the owner of the marketing agency. There's someone out there involved in marketing somehow that hears you speaking and wants to know more and might be curious. Where do they find you and how do we find you on social and your websites?
Yeah. LinkedIn is easy. Gray McKenzie should be the first result that pops up there. For folks, it is a little weird to spell G-R-A-Y. But connect, you'll see a lot of really good content coming from me and from the team around project management and ClickUp. And then the website is just zenpilot.com. You can book a call from the website and talk to us, but you can also check out we have over 100 educational guides on project management, agency ops, and ClickUp.
This is super cool. You got to check out Gray's LinkedIn. I'm looking at it right now. He looks like a rock star on his LinkedIn. I mean, literally, this is pretty cool. It's different. It stands out. He's got a bunch of followers on it. So yeah, this is pretty cool. This is pretty cool. So thank you for gifting us with your social accounts. If we want to talk to you directly, do we just email you directly, or we just message you directly through one of your accounts or your website?
Yeah. If you go to zenpilot.com/call, you can book a call directly there.
Okay. Sweet. Sweet, sweet, sweet. Well, I'd love to move to wrap up with you now. This has been amazing just to chat with you for a little while. And I'm super curious about what you do. So maybe we even have a different conversation after this. I'd love to start to ask this, though. If you're a reader, then what might be a book recommendation that you can share with our audience that's been impactful for you?
Yeah, recently, this is a really simple one. How to Be a Great Boss is part of the EOS library of books. And it's a really simple book. I used to view leadership and management as kind of enemies. I don't want to be a manager. I want to be a leader. I want people to follow me, not do what I say because I'm their manager.
Yeah.
And that book was helpful in kind of reshaping the thought around, you know, you need both leadership and management to ultimately create accountability, which is what accountability is, one of the most universal attributes of high performing teams. those high performing teams are always synonymous with high accountability cultures.
Fantastic. Love it. How to be a great boss. How about your music? Is there a song or a genre or an artist that really just fills your bucket, gets you fired up?
Yeah, man, there's a bunch. This would be maybe lower key. Matt Papa is a Christian artist who writes just some really good, very simple music, really, really good lyrics.
I'm going to Spotify for our puzzle night tonight. I'm going to do that. Thank you. Hopefully when the Pacers are crushing the Knicks, we'll see that. Sorry, New York fans. I know I got more New York listeners than Indiana listeners. I used to live in Indiana, though, so there's that. So last question, and we'll leave it at this, and this will take us home. This is the Eternal Optimist podcast. When we say Eternal Optimist, what does that mean to you?
Eternal Optimist, I think anyone who's a Christian is an Eternal Optimist. It's not a mystery. We already know what happens. The good guy wins. And so that's ultimately the reason for you asked, you said this really well, I think maybe before we started recording, but like, what's the good in this or what's the gift in this? And there's always good and gifts in what's coming because we know the ending.